From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the National Women's Law Center, more than 16 million women are living in poverty, or were in 2016. Nearly 900,000 of them are in Georgia. Why are so many women poor? Well, we're looking at the complex relationship between women and money, beginning with how we got here. George Robb is author of Ladies of the Ticker, Women and Wall Street from the Gilded Age to the Great Depression. He's history professor at William Patterson University. And George, good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us, Diana Pierce. She's director of the Center for Women's Welfare. She's a social work professor at the University of Washington. And Diana, thank you for being with us on this early hour for a West Coaster.
Thank you, too.
Diana, you are the woman who coined the phrase, the feminization of poverty. Now, where did this come from?
Well, it came from a trend towards more and more families in poverty being maintained by women alone. So that was disproportionate. In the early 70s, it was about a quarter of families. It then moved up to about half of families, and it stayed that way ever since. And there's two basic reasons for that. One is that women are disadvantaged in the labor force. There's a wage gap, which has closed, but has stopped closing in the last 15, 18 years.
So let's pick that up. George, you've studied this historically. Now, what are some of the cultural or historic factors that have made women more prone to poverty, both in those cases that she was talking about, labor force and wage gap?
Well, there are historical deep roots for women's economic disadvantages. Most American women couldn't even vote until 1920. They weren't fully citizens. For centuries, women were under the legal guardianship of their husbands. They couldn't sign contracts. They couldn't own property. They had no right to their wages if they earned money. And this only began to change in some states in the 1850s. In other states, not until the 20th century. And the worst case I can think of, I'm sorry to say, is Georgia, where married women didn't have a right to their own wages until 1945.
Hmm. And your book, Ladies of the Ticker, talks about how women played essential roles in areas like banking and the stock market. This is during the late 19th century and early 20th century. Wasn't that considered unladylike?
It was considered very unladylike, and these women were constantly pushing against barriers, of people not wanting to share investment information with them or not wanting to employ them in financial industries. And this idea of separate spheres, that women's proper place was in the home, they needed to be sheltered from the rough and tumble world of money making. So when women tried to do unconventional things like work in banks or make money on the stock market, they were accused of becoming unsexed. That's the term they used 100 years ago, this idea that if they entered the world of work, they would become masculine, they would become aggressive, they would become unlovely, no one would want to marry them. These kinds of ideas. Had strong cultural resonance at the time.
And Diana, this is a critical point. Around that same time, early 20th century, New Deal social programs, including what came to be known as welfare. How did welfare aim to address the particular needs of women?
At the time when women became poor, they ended up having to put their children in orphanages. Many times the jobs that they had were things like live-in maid. They were not allowed to bring their children with them. So if they lost their husband, they could not both work and take care of their children, and there was no child care. So children in orphanages weren't orphans. They were the children of single mothers. So welfare was intended to address that.
And we have some big changes in women's economic prospects during the war. Of course, many women went to work with the absence of men. During World War II, there was this surge. George, did women start below men on the salary scale?
Oh, always, always. And even in some industries that were, or some jobs that were highly feminized, like teaching or clerical work, that was the advantage of hiring women. You didn't have to pay them as much. The idea was they didn't have families to support, which wasn't always true. And many, well into the 20th century, a lot of school districts and a lot of corporations had a marriage bar so that they would only hire single women, and most women are going to get married. And at the point you get married, you have to give up your job.
Hmm.
And this was also an excuse for not promoting women because it's like, oh, they're eventually going to get married and leave, so we won't promote them.
And we see this double standard. Women were making money. Could they, however, apply for loans and housing and other benefits that men returning from the war could?
They could. Banks were very happy to take women's money, to take their deposits, but not to loan them money. So women historically have had much less access to credit, and that, I think, continues to be a problem.
I'm wondering, you know, when did we come up with this stereotype of women only knowing how to shop and to spend money when in so many houses they were the traditional, let's say, managers of the purse?
You know, that's an old stereotype, but you're right to point out there's this disjuncture that, you know, in the Victorian period, women were managing tight household budgets, and some middle-class women had several servants they were hiring and firing, and, you know, their house was like a small little business. And yet the reality was that women knew how to manage money, but the kind of the public image, the cultural images, the propaganda, if you will, was that women were these flighty things that couldn't balance their checkbook and, you know, were spendthrifts and all of that. And so there's definitely this contradiction between the reality and public images.
Right. Diana, this traditional image, women receiving her husband's check each pay period and then managing the money. How about for single women? What were the particular challenges for them?
Well, again, the problem of both working and taking care of your children. So, and now today, the problem is only having one income. And as costs have continued to rise, particularly in the 21st century, having two incomes is necessary in almost everywhere for families to be able to support children.
What is the wage to cost balance with women now in terms of the money that they have to spend?
Well, the costs are going up faster than people's wages. We're finding that everywhere. Using an alternative measure of the cost of living called the self-sufficiency standard, we find that in Georgia as well as Washington, New York, every place, costs are going up faster than people's wages. The costs went up even during the Great Recession when people's wages stagnated or fell or their hours fell. What's happening is that people are shifting to jobs that are lower paying at the same time that costs like rent and food and health care, child care, the basics are going up. They're going up faster than prices in general, and they're going up certainly faster than wages.
Poverty rates continue to rise among women across the country and here in Georgia. And we're talking about some of the roots of female poverty. Diana Pierce is with us. She is the woman who coined the term, the feminization of poverty, and George Robb, author of Ladies of the Ticker. He wrote about some of the women who broke ground as entrepreneurs and investors in the early 20th century. George, that term, feminization of poverty, is still considered controversial. Why?
A lot of people want to deny that those kinds of gaps exist. And I think America has this image of itself where, where we don't have class, or this myth that everyone's middle class. And, you know, rich people want to call themselves middle class, and many working poor people will apply that term to themselves. So this, you know, creates a kind of reality or makes it difficult for people to talk about class barriers.
And Diana, we're talking about gender gap, but what about women of color who've been left behind in the economy?
Of course, racism also plays a part. And for women of color, they're experiencing both sexism and racism in the labor force. And, of course, they face the same costs in terms of housing and child care and that kind of thing as white women. But they face it with lower wages. Consistently lower wages across the board.
We did ask some Atlanta women about their personal experiences.
Some of the reasons for poverty among women would be not having the resources from their family.
I think the most obvious one is the pay discrepancy, the salary discrepancy in the workplace.
I think probably lack of education, original family home life, the growing situation, and employment.
I think it would be the family structures with fathers not standing in the place and taking care of the home and women having to step up.
Those are the voices of Andrea Mulvaney, Esmerit Twell Daberhan, and Sue Seglia. So these are some of the old saws that we've heard a lot about, you know, the family structures, women having to step up. How about in the workforce currently? What are the challenges that women face in the workforce in particular? Who wants to pick that up? George, Diana?
Well, I think one of the things that is true in the workforce is that women are occupationally segregated. As George pointed out, women were brought into the labor force, but concentrated in certain professions like teaching and nursing. But other than those professions, they've been concentrated in low-wage jobs, child care, administrative assistants, what we used to call secretaries, and those kinds of jobs, service sector jobs. And when you concentrate people in a particular occupation, and it's a low-wage occupation, you get locked in, and it becomes difficult to get higher wages. So occupational segregation is a piece of it. But there's also the economic costs of things like sexual harassment. If you're sexually harassed, what most women do is leave the job, and that has economic costs and affects their ability going forward to promote their career and move up in terms of income.
These attitudes, these structures, sound like deeply embedded in our culture and history. So, George, what's the way out? Policy? Is it attitudes? Where do we go from here?
Well, it's a lot of things. I think that, you know, we have a lot of laws in the books right now against sexist hiring and promotion practices and against penalizing women for taking maternity leaves. But those laws aren't any good unless they're enforced. And a lot of women are afraid to complain. They can't afford lawyers. District attorneys and attorneys general have to be willing to prosecute corporations, for example. And I think in today's political climate, there's little pressure from Washington to go after big business. That's one problem right there.
Well, Diana, your center at the University of Washington, this is the project of the Center for Women's Welfare, known as the Self-Sufficiency Standard. Now, what are you doing in this program?
What we're doing is calculating what the basic cost of living is and comparing that, as I did earlier, to wages. So, for example, in New York, it's going up 80% over the decade, and wages have only gone up about 30%. So everywhere you look, you have this gap, this increasing gap. So what we're doing is pointing out what it really costs to meet your basic needs.
Right. And from there, determining what? Way forward?
Looking at ways to, there's basically two ways to get to the self-sufficiency level. One is to increase wages, raising the minimum wage, more labor power in terms of unions, and then lowering costs, such things as child care assistance or universal preschool. Things like that that will lower the costs on the cost side of the equation. And expanding those kinds of programs, healthcare, covering healthcare costs, those kinds of things make a big difference because it doesn't matter whether your income goes up or your costs go down, but either way that gets you, you know, there. And if you do some of both, that's important.
Well, we're going to be looking at that in the rest of the show, but thank you so much for your perspective, Diana Pierce.
Thank you.
Diana Pierce is director of the Center for Women's Welfare and Social Work professor at the University of Washington. George, Rob, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Why are women poor? Well, we're exploring that question this hour. Women are overrepresented in low-paying jobs and 35% more likely to live in poverty. How is the wealth gap affecting you? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or Facebook at OST Talk. Shilpa Fadke joins us now to talk about how poverty affects women and families in Georgia. She's vice president of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. We're speaking with her from her office. Hello, Shilpa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you recently co-authored a report on economic security for women and families in Georgia. This is a national issue, of course. In what ways is it a Southern problem?
Sure. So I think in the last several years, we've seen real progress talking about women and their families and opportunities for economic security and prosperity. There's a lot of talk around issues like equal pay, paid sick days, access to health care, access to affordable child care. And in many states and localities around the country, we've seen real progress. But in the South, there's really just a lot of work that is still needed to promote economic security and make sure that all families are able to get ahead. And there's just there's a lot of interest there. And so I think if we think about women in Georgia in particular, we know that there's just still a significant wage gap. And that wage gap has lots of reasons, which we can get into. But until we sort of push through that, women and their families in Georgia just really won't see true equality.
So you mentioned the wage gap, but what are some of the other big factors that make women here more vulnerable than men when it comes to financial instability or insecurity?
Sure. So part of that is the wage gap, which, of course, disproportionately impacts women of color. If you look at black women, Latinas in Georgia, you know, they're earning 63 cents, 50 cents compared to every dollar that a white man earns. And over their lifetime, that's just compounded. So our report, you know, indicates that women in Georgia, because of the wage gap, are going to lose over $300,000 in their lifetime. It's a significant amount of money, and that's money that could be spent in securing retirement. It's funds that could get passed down to ensure economic mobility for their children and grandchildren. And as we think about those issues, there's a lot of reasons. It's the lack of paid family leave. It's a lack of quality, affordable child care. It's a lack of protections around gender-based violence, and that's sexual assault, sexual harassment. All of those issues together sort of combine to give us a status in Georgia that is really detrimental to the progress of women.
How many women in Georgia do work for minimum wage?
When you think about minimum wage, first of all, I think the most important thing to think about is that most of minimum wage workers are women. And to really understand that, you know, for example, I think it's one in four low-wage workers really are grappling with so many of the issues. So if you think about, I think it's 6 in 10 in Georgia are women, and that 2/3 of those workers are women, increasing the minimum wage just to $15 an hour would boost the wages for nearly 1 million women in Georgia and more than 23 million women around the country.
Well, Shilpa, now we're looking at, for a minimum wage worker in Georgia with tips, who make tips, $2.13 an hour, $15 an hour by 2024, sounds like a pretty big climb. Is that feasible in this state?
I think if we can make the case to talk about how the minimum wage will really help women and families and help support their families and get them out of poverty and get families on a track for success and opportunity, I think we can get there, but we have to tell a story, and we have to have people ready to understand the data, to understand what, you know, the increase in wages would do for their workforce and how it would really contribute to the state's economic security.
In the report, you also do write that in Georgia, mothers are the sole or primary or co-breadwinners in a majority of families, 66.3% of families. These numbers are higher for some women of color. So how does that affect their families?
Right. So if your household is headed by a woman that is bringing home, you know, the vast amount of resources for that family, and they then all of a sudden have an emergency caregiving, a sick spouse, a sick child, they become sick, a sick parent, there is no cushion. There is no ability for that family to sort of get by. And oftentimes the lack of caregiving supports, or, you know, coupled with potentially a health care crisis, can result in women having to leave the workforce. Those gaps are challenging. They end up dipping into whatever savings they have, and they can't get out of it. And so I think as we think about these policies, we can't think about them in silos. We have to really think about how they are all connected to each other.
On the subject of policy, access to health care is one of the things that you highlight in your report. Greater access to health care is one place Georgia really needs to improve. So what is that relationship between health care and poverty?
I think we know that women need access to comprehensive health care so that they can thrive. And if we really want to ensure that families are thriving, we need to guarantee access to quality health care. You know, for example, Georgia has the 6th highest infant mortality rate. And maternal mortality is something we've been talking a lot about here at the Center for American Progress and around the country. And so, you know, if women are dying, if their children are dying, if they don't have access to high quality care, how can you expect, you know, a woman and their family to sort of take the economic steps that they would need to? And so if you don't have access to healthcare, it's really just a bedrock for women's economic security. And that's, you know, a range of healthcare services.
We're learning how the gender pay gap and lack of access to healthcare are affecting women here in Georgia. Woola Dawson is also with us. She works at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta. Woola, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So you were hearing a little bit about what she was talking about, big picture, stats. But how about for you? What is an average day like at the Feminist Women Health Center?
Sure. So we provide comprehensive gynecological care. So that means that we have people come and get wellness exams. They can have GYN exams. We have STI testing and treatment, HIV testing and counseling, all kinds of the full range of family planning and emergency contraception. We also have a long history of being a place that's accessible for LGBT folks. So folks who are gender nonconforming and want to come and get a GYN exam, we are a place where you can come and do that as well.
And how about reproductive health care specifically?
Right. So we do the full range of abortion care, right? So we have offer medical and surgical abortions as far along as it is into the second trimester allowed here in the state of Georgia, which is 21 weeks. So people come from all over the state to see us, right? Because most counties do not have abortion providers that will go as far along as we do. And a lot of the people that we serve, 75% of them would identify as being in poverty. So a lot of folks come to us because we're the only place that can really provide the services that they need. So we don't provide the full range of care every day, but on the days that we have abortion services, our parking lot is full. We have protesters across the street, sometimes with megaphones. And folks come with their stories telling us about the waiting period where they live or other barriers. Many people receive discounts just because they can't afford the procedures that they get. So we work with some partners, and we also have a sliding scale for our own services that we provide.
So Feminist Women's Health Center, that's a loaded word in our culture now, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
Has it become code for access to birth control and abortions despite all of the other services that you offer?
Well, I think what's important to us is that we believe that families should have options and that we are here to provide this really important need. And the word isn't that important. You know, we are here to support the people who need these services. I think it gets tricky, right? Like, feminist means something different to different folks. The people who need healthcare just need healthcare. Mm. And there are people who are really committed to forcing people to be parents and making it harder for parents that are already parents to take care of the kids that they have and can't see the full spectrum of what it means to bring a child into this world beyond this one decision.
Well, you're talking very much to the politics in Georgia, especially around women's health care. Shilpa, birth control, abortion, some very hot button issues here. So what are some of the obstacles to women's health care here in Georgia?
I think at the end of the day, there's an effort to really set women back and sort of try to ensure that they don't have access to everything they need. And so I think we really want to think about, what does access to high quality care look like? Is that family planning? Is that access to abortion? Is it better, you know, maternal and prenatal care? Is it access to federal Title X funding, which is everything from cancer screenings to pregnancy testing? And so I think it's critical for Georgia and folks in the state to have access to that full spectrum of care. And there's really no way to disconnect access to health care and access to economic security. Reproductive justice, economic justice, those things go hand in hand. And I think if we try to think about the economy of the country, the economy of the South, the economy of Georgia, there is no way to think about growing those opportunities and having families that are thriving without really centering a conversation around access to health care.
How do unwanted pregnancies impact women's income?
Yeah, we did a study a couple years ago really looking at labor mobility and looked at, you know, some of the state laws and the waiting periods and the other things. And it's statistically significant. The states that are hostile to women, the states that have these really these out-of-touch laws on access to abortion and contraception are states that have a disproportionate impact on women's ability to thrive. And so it really impacts the mobility of women to move around and to be successful. And so I think, you know, connecting the dots and connecting the economic story here is really critical.
So you've done comparative studies in other states?
We've looked at different states and looked at some of the sort of cross-cutting issues. And I think we feel pretty strongly that access to reproductive health care is crucial to this conversation, and that the research has showed that you have greater earning potential and job mobility in states where reproductive health care is more available. And if you compare that to other states, you see the difference. And I think Georgia and many states in the South have a situation right now where women's earnings and mobility is really being constricted by these, by the lack of sort of true equitable health care access.
Well, we know that the Women's Right to Know law from 2005 required counseling and a waiting period, which abortion activists and doctors agree create hurdles for abortion seekers. What are you doing as an organization to create legislative priorities for people who seek reproductive health care?
So there's a United States Supreme Court ruling 2 years ago that all abortion restrictions should have provable health benefits. So we're so excited because we're bringing that campaign to Georgia. So if we put this into Georgia law to be in keeping with the United States government, then that would take down this interference between doctors and patients. Many, many people come to this procedure for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it has to do with fetal anomaly. Sometimes these are really difficult choices that people have to make, right? And so, you know, being offered to hear the heartbeat, it's obviously slated towards a bias towards not ending pregnancies. So we're super excited. It's really hopeful that we're moving, we're starting this effort to bring folks together. There's the Amplify campaign, which is a citywide level of doing similar abortion out loud work. And we're excited about the momentum that's happening and how much more comfortable people are talking about this care and their own experiences. So we just had a public hearing to launch the campaign to enact the Whole Woman's Health Act here in the state of Georgia.
So I'm curious about this because oftentimes when women's issues are discussed, you know, and I'm putting quotes around, air quotes mm-hmm. around that in my hands, this is considered a matter of identity politics. This is not considered to be a national priority, certainly not on the legislative agenda right now. What's your case to political leadership to treat it differently?
If we care about an economy, and if we care about being successful globally, and if we care about being a leader in the world, then we have to make sure that workers in this country and in every state have access to all the policies and the programs that would make them able to thrive and be part of an innovative, dynamic economy. Those policies have been lagging, whether it's increasing the minimum wage, ensuring workers have access to paid sick days, affordable child care, you know, the ability to care for themselves, a sick parent. All of these pieces are critical to having a dynamic economy. And so if we care about having a strong economy, if we care about making sure the workers around the country have the skills and the wages to thrive, then this is what you need to do to get there. And the misogyny and the patriarchy that are sort of embedded in these policies, it's not the time anymore. We really have to take these issues head on. These are not women's issues. These are family issues. These are workers' issues. And really just own them and figure out a path to getting these things across the finish line.
But the political will, as you're suggesting, doesn't seem to be there. People are much more considered with things that they consider more immediate pocketbook issues or issues like abortion, that these are culture war issues. I'm still trying to understand how to make the case to the larger public that this is in their best interest.
I think having a strong, dynamic economy where everyone can thrive and succeed is in the interest of every single citizen and every single person that sort of wants to contribute to make sure that families are able to get ahead and get by. I think that at times we get stuck on buzzwords and people go to their partisan corners. But I think if you ask people, do you think women and families deserve to make a living wage? Do you think that we should ensure that people have access to care for themselves or their loved ones if they're sick? Do you think that women deserve to get paid the same for the same work as their colleagues that are men? I think the answers to those questions are yes. And so if we can sort of dig a little bit deeper, ask the hard questions, push lawmakers for real solutions, not just sort of the talking point or the half solution, I think we can get there. But I think it's really up to us and up to women everywhere to demand these policies and to demand these solutions. and to do that for themselves, but for their families. I'd say it again, these aren't women's issues. Access to health care is a family issue, and it's critical to the economic security of our country.
Shilpa Fadke, she is Vice President of the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Wula Dawson at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta, thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, how three Georgia women are chipping away at the glass ceiling. It's on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're changing things up a bit in our break room. Their guests are taking a break. Instead, we have a group of women who work in finance to talk about women and finance. We've got a wonderful sight around the table with Tara Jackson. She's the founder of the financial blog Madam Money. Tara, thank you.
Thank you.
So glad you're here. Helen Ngo is a certified financial planner at Capital Benchmark Partners. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
And Maddie Gilroy, she's Senior Assurance Associate at an Atlanta firm. Hello, Maddie.
Hi.
Well, big picture, we've been hearing a lot about women and money today. Do women have a different relationship to money than men? Long pause.
I know, right? Like, who's going to go first? I do think that women have different relationships. We all have relatively the same relationships, and I talk about that in my upcoming book. There are four financial languages. But women, we do have a different, we have an emotional tie to how we deal with money, whereas men may have an analytical with everything else. So emotionally, if I'm a spender, I'm going to spend when I'm very emotional. So we just have different, I think we have different perspectives and a different emotional scale that controls some of the things that we do with spending.
How about the rest of you? Have you seen emotional connections with women and money that obviously in your work you have to work with?
I don't know if it's a difference in emotions. I think everybody has an emotional tie to money, whether it's men or women. But I do think that we assess risk in managing money and what type of investments we take on is quite different than men. It doesn't mean that we take on less risk. I think that is an actual misunderstanding in the market that women take on less risk. We just assess it differently.
Oh, that's Helen. How about you, Maddie?
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Helen.
Well, so this is a really interesting thought that women have been the traditional holders of the purse strings and managing money and budgets within families, but not thought of as responsible enough to have the final say on big purchases. Now, do you think, how would you advise a woman who is trying to manage money and not feeling like she's really in control of the family budget?
In dealing with my clients, one of the common responses I hear when because I deal with couples, and when they come in, especially with the older generations, they usually the guy comes in and he's the dominant one taking over the conversation, and I always ask him to bring his wife too, and I get her to open up. And the one comment they always say is, "I'm not good with math." And I said, "I don't think that's true. If you can add, subtract, and do basic arithmetic, you know how to manage your finances, because it's money coming in, money going out. Mm-hmm. It's not calculus that you're trying to do with money."
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's a real strong self-perception. Do you find that with the women that you work with, that they have this idea that they're not good with money and therefore they kind of shut it off?
I think they just don't. I think some of them just don't have an interest in what the financial markets really are. And I ask him that directly, and they said, "Yeah, I really just don't have an interest. He's taken care of it, so I don't want to get involved." And I said, "But it's the financial household of your entire family, and what are you going to do when he passes away or something happens to him, and you don't know how to even access the money?"
Well, so that's a very traditional heterosexual relationship, right? How about for single women? How about
exactly.
for other families?
So most of my clients are single women, and where we are the head of household, because I'm a single mom as well. And so there could be some things that we're afraid to tap into. Mm-hmm. There could be some avoidance that's happening there. But there's a lot of responsibility of being a single mom. Now you're the decision maker, CEO, CFO, COO of the family. And so a lot of people that I've talked to are afraid to talk about money because they don't know. They weren't taught in schools. Their parents didn't teach them. So they're learning on trial and error, heavy on the air. But when we have the conversation, that's when it opens up and is not as scary in there. And I do hear a lot about, well, I'm not good with math. Mm-hmm. That's why I can't budget. Well, if you can add and subtract or if you can spend money, you're good in math.
Yeah. Well, Maddie, you work in a big financial firm. So we have this impression of the financial world as being very cutthroat, very anti-female. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that to a certain extent. But I think the shift is definitely changing for women. And I think it's important we have the confidence to believe in ourselves and know that we are just as capable as men.
Mm-hmm. And others, I mean, is that something you have to encourage your clients to do?
That is really big. What she just mentioned is to our confidence levels to do that. Because most women, I read a study, most women won't apply for a job if they're not 80% of the qualifications, but men will apply for the job if they're 50% or less. Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, they'll still get the job and learn it on the way. And so when we build up our confidence and say, you know, I have at least 4 out of the 10 or whatever, and have the confidence to do that, we'll have more opportunities. But a lot of the opportunities are stifled because we don't have the confidence in pursuing certain things.
And I've heard the same thing about women not as willing to ask for raises in their jobs. Yes. So I'm hearing Madam Money talking here, Tara. So tell me about Madam Money, this entity that you created.
Well, Madam Money, I wrote a book called Financial Fornication, and I just take a very...
Great title.
Thank you. I take a very intimidating conversation and turn it into something fun. So I talk about our personal and physical relationships and turn it into financial relationships, how we're financially promiscuous with our credit, not with just one credit card, but multiple. And we have all these financial one-night stands, and we end up with financial STDs, substantially tremendous debt, and we need cures, right? We need to learn how to date our banks, the 5 stages of it, so we don't get in a financially abusive relationship. And if we are, we need exit strategies. And so when I started the blog Madam Money, it really came from the book and trying to provide tips to people so that they don't feel intimidated by having the conversation, or at least starting the conversation. And I guess Madam Money just kind of stuck because financial fornication. But my whole goal is to make money matters manageable and to take intimidating conversations and break them down in a fun conversation. So that's relatively what I do, and people like for me to have a microphone to talk about that.
Well, we're glad you're on one this morning, but I want to pick up on that. This is a study from Starling Bank. This is analyzed the way that advertisers write to both men and women customers, and found that 65% of magazine ads portrayed women as excessive spenders, you know, saying like, you know, you're spending a lot. Why don't you make the safe choice and encourage them to save money? So very interesting. You were talking about the financial promiscuity. Do you think that that is aimed at women in particular, that there's this idea that you can't manage money? And where does that go?
Yeah, it's, you know, I think in society we think, oh, women, all they do is go shopping and buy shoes and handbags. But that's not always true. Men go out and buy shoes and handbags,
electronics
or other things. But why don't we ever talk about that? I look at people's budgets all the time, and you'll see, like, he's actually the one who's not saving, and the woman's the one who's a little bit more conservative. So I think there's an overhype that women are bad spenders. We just spend on different things than men. It doesn't mean that we're bad.
That's Helen. No, she's a certified financial planner at Capital Benchmark Partners. She has the Live and Earn podcast. You heard from Tara Jackson, the founder of the financial blog Madam Money, and Maddie Gilroy is also with us. She's senior associate, assurance associate at an Atlanta firm. We've been discussing the importance of women and money in the financial world and some of the challenges that they face. And I want to pick up on that idea of how women are portrayed as heavy spenders, and whether that self-perception goes further. And in this case, has political implications. Currently, Stacey Abrams, she's being questioned on whether or not she would be fit to be governor based on her debt. Valid point?
No.
Sexist point?
That's a very sexist point, because there's a lot of men that have more debt than she has. Mm-hmm. And I think they're using that to distract people from what she was trying to say. I don't care. She has $200,000 or $2 million in debt. It's based on how she can perform. But it's a very, I'm really not liking that story, because if you look at it, the way we control the United States, how much are we in debt? Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. And that's never an issue when it comes with a man going for election. Mm-hmm. Now, when a woman goes for the same position or an election, they're trying to pull. It's almost like they're trying to pull something to distract us from the true issues within that. So, I don't really care if she had $200,000 or $2 million in debt. Can she perform the job?
Any other thoughts, Maddie? Have you got any thoughts on that? Or, you know, about the sort of perception of women as big, heavy spenders and what that does to their self-perception? You want to decline?
Yeah.
She politely declines.
Helen, did you have something with that before I...
Again, just to reemphasize, I think that is just a place to blame us, right? And it doesn't really create influence or positive influence for women. I mean, imagine a young girl or woman listening to this and they're like, oh, I'm a bad spender. And they hear that constantly. Then you're going to think that you're a bad spender.
Okay, so we got an email. Female millennials are significantly more stressed out than their male peers about their finances. And with good reason. 42% earn an income annually of $50,000 or more versus 57% of millennial men. Average total debt higher than male counterparts. Is female debt higher? Have you noticed that?
I don't know if the female debt is higher. Like I said, people have four dominant language, financial languages. They're either spenders, savers, investors, or givers. Well, right?
So you're picking up on this love language
idea. Exactly. But we have dominant languages. We can be fiscally bilingual and speak all four. But like, I'm a spender. I speak spending. So I'm a financial fornicator, hence financial fornication, right? But it doesn't make me any better than a saver, because I can oversave. It's all about excessive in that. And I don't think that it's just women are financial fornicators. I think men are financial fornicators as well. Like Helen said, with some of my clients, the husband is the one that does all the spending.
Yeah, but I want to get in there because, you know, the idea of financial abstinence, that's, it's often this perception of, you know, you're either a big spender or you just don't give anything to yourself. You know, that's a lot, something that a lot of women talk about, you know, spending on their kids or their families or other people instead of themselves. Is that something you've picked up on, Helen?
They do spend on themselves, but they tend to, just from the comments, they express themselves as it's guilt, right? When they do take a girl's vacation versus, oh, I'm going to go on a man's trip and it's okay. And that's perceived as, okay, he can take a break because he's providing for the family. Mm-hmm. But then when it's the woman in the relationship, we almost kind of shame her for taking a day off or a weekend off to go with her girlfriends.
So you are, Helen, a Vietnamese-American, and I just wondered if there's anything in particular inside of immigrant communities, this kind of concept of making it in America. Mm-hmm. How do you advise them, and how do they tend to think about money in your client base?
From my personal experience
and
my upbringing, we were very tight with money because—
So abstinence.
Yeah. You know, it's been pounded in my head ever since I grew up that we were poor, we don't have enough money. You need to store as much away as possible, right? And no, we cannot afford that bike at this time.
Right.
But we're going to pay for your education.
So priorities.
Priorities are, education. When we came over here, we brought you over here for a reason. We escaped Vietnam for a reason. So you better make something of yourself. So that's what I've heard my entire life, you know?
But so, I'm sorry, were you going to pick up on something? The idea of, you know, you are all women in the workplace in various different ways. And what we've been hearing on the program today is like how things are in some ways historically biased. It's kind of baked in the cake about women in the workplace and their importance. And I just wondered, I'm shocked to hear if any of you have encountered sexism inside of the workplace.
Oh, that should be another show.
I know, that's a whole other.
So you reserve that for the last 2 minutes.
Out there, throwing that out there with 2 minutes left to go.
Yeah, it has. For me, I think at some point I made the decision to not really care what other people thought or said or what the media thought or said about me. And I I looked at the common denominator. I looked at the common denominator of all of this, whether I was getting paid enough, whether I was dealing with sexism, and that was me and how I perceived and how I acted. And when I start focusing on the common denominator that I did spend a lot or I needed to save more or I needed to ask for that raise. But the sexism in the workplace is very, very real. I've been in several situations where I was offered a job and I knew that the other person, which was a male, got offered the same job and was offered more money in that. But that came in with my negotiation skills. So because I knew that, I learned how to ask for more. Even if it scared me, I still asked for more money. And then when I started to do that, you know, I had to close my own wage gap because I understood what I was worth in those situations. But sexism in the workplace is real. Sexual abuse, you know, sexual harassment is very, very real. It's with the Me Too movement, the light is being shined on it. So I think people are more afraid to go that route. But I think all of us has dealt with it one shape or
form. I'm getting nods around the table, and that's all that we're going to be able to hear right now, or nods around the table, because we have to close. I want to thank you all so much for being here. Tara Jackson, the founder of the financial blog, Madam Money, thank you.
Thank you.
And Helen Noh, she's a certified financial planner at Capital Benchmark Partners, and the Live and Earn podcast is where she gets her voice out there. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you so much.
Maddie Gilroy, Senior Assurance Associate at an Atlanta firm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. That's it for The Break Room today, a different kind of break room. And that's our show for today. We always want to hear from you. This month, we began a series on what different cultures across Georgia say is true barbecue. We asked you for your barbecue recommendations. Sam Burnham told us on Twitter to check out Heavy's Barbecue in Crawfordville, if only for the slaw. And Amanda Beth also reached out to us on Twitter. She said Pulaski Heights Barbecue in Athens is definitely one of the best BBQ joints in Georgia. Thank you to Sam and Amanda for the recommendations. Now, if you're a longtime listener to On Second Thought, you know we love talking about Southern dishes, whether it's barbecue, mac and cheese, or sweet tea. But not everyone is sold on those conversations. Listener Steve Carr left us this voicemail.
Sometimes y'all have good programs that's substantive, that's got political import to it. However, talking about Southern food is not. So if I were to rate today's program, let's see, what kind of category can I put into it? Well, the word fluff comes to mind, and that's an F word. So it's in the F category. Fluff, 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 fluff. Come on, y'all are better than this.
Thanks so much for your comment, Steve. You can always find us on Facebook or on Twitter or leave a message at 404-500-9457. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.